This candidate for president, like many others, is stumping on environmental issues.
I think that human beings do affect the climate, and I'm a big supporter of solar and wind.
But you might be surprised to learn he's a Republican. I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we join the political fray to learn more about what would-be presidents really think about fracking and climate change. And
coal mining has done a lot for the communities, and it's done a lot for the people that work at them.
But what happens when the company that pays your bills goes bankrupt? Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. In the thick of primary and caucus season, the two Democratic presidential candidates are locked in a battle for their party's nomination. At a CNN debate in Flint, Michigan, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders talked about environmental issues, including lead contamination. Clinton also got a chance to speak up on a hot-button issue for many in her party's base, fracking. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains.
The question came from a student in Michigan.
Do you support fracking?
Hillary Clinton's answer included a list of conditions that would have to be met in order for her to be okay with hydraulic fracturing.
I don't support it when the release of methane or contamination of water is present.
Also, companies would need to fully disclose the chemicals they used, and there would need to be local approval for any projects.
So by the time we get through all of my conditions, I do not think there will be many places in America where fracking will continue to take place.
These were strong words, especially from Clinton. As Secretary of State, she supported fracking as a way to get the U.S. off of foreign oil and gas and encouraged America's allies to do the same. So what's behind Clinton's tough talk on fracking? Terry Madonna, a pollster at Franklin and Marshall College, said, check the calendar. It's primary season, and Democratic primary voters are much more liberal than voters in the general election.
It's clearly a concerted plan to move to the left to gain the support of those voters, as well as to, you know, go after the support base that Sanders has picked up.
Bringing her closer to where Bernie Sanders stands on the issue.
My answer is a lot shorter. No, I do not support fracking.
But even with the tough talk on fracking, it remains an open question how much either candidate would be able to do to limit fracking if elected. Amy Mall of the environmental group NRDC Action Fund said many of the laws that could be used to further regulate fracking, like the Safe Drinking Water Act, would have to be changed by Congress.
But within current law, there are things that an administration can do to strengthen the rules.
Like further tightening existing rules on air pollution from oil and gas wells and the disposal of solid waste from the oil and gas industry. Also, there's another issue to be considered. Analysts say less fracking could mean more coal, which would be worse for climate change. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Might hear that song at a certain presidential campaign rally. Rolling Stone magazine says Donald Trump chooses the songs himself. He and fellow Republicans are also talking about fracking and climate change on the campaign trail. Trump told a crowd in New Orleans this week he thinks he'll win in New York because he supports fracking. The state's Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, has banned it. Here's audio from the online DeSmog blog.
Do you know if they fracked in New York would lower its taxes, would have no debt, would have made a fortune. Instead, Pennsylvania took all their money. They took that, they took those beautiful, beautiful natural resources. They took them out. Sort of funny. Pennsylvania, you have a line. You have the fracking equipment all up and down that line. In New York, you have nothing. In Pennsylvania, they're driving Cadillacs.
Well, maybe not all of us. As for climate change, Trump's called it a hoax, set up to benefit Chinese manufacturers. Republican contender Marco Rubio's laid out an energy policy that would rely on drilling and fracking and would roll back efforts by the Obama administration to combat climate change. Here's Rubio at CNN's debate last September.
Every proposal they put forward are going to be proposals that will make it harder to do business in America. So we are not going to destroy our economy. We are not going to make America a harder place to create jobs in order to pursue policies that will do absolutely nothing, nothing to change our climate, to change our weather.
Rubio said he believes climate change is real, but it's not caused by human activity. Not so for Texan Ted Cruz. He hosted a Senate hearing on climate change in December. At the end of it, he listed reasons why he's not convinced climate change is happening. One reason, he says carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. It's good for plants. Cruz went on.
For the last 18 years, the satellite data and the weather balloon data both demonstrate no significant warming whatsoever.
NASA analyzes that data a little differently. And the Washington Post reported this week that two prominent satellite data sets both show that February 2016 was the hottest month ever recorded. Ohio Governor John Kasich has distinguished himself somewhat among the other Republican candidates when it comes to global warming. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant decided to take a closer look at Kasich's environmental views and at his record.
When John Kasich first hit the campaign trail last summer, Pope Francis had just published an historic environmental encyclical. It made climate change a moral issue and called on people to change their consumerist behaviors in response. Some GOP candidates criticized the religious leader for speaking out on political issues. When asked by a reporter from Undercurrent, Kasich had a different response.
So I think the Pope pointing out the fact that we need to take care of this environment is good. I don't agree with his conclusion that all of it is bad because of free enterprise, because it's lifted people out of poverty, and he cares about the poor, and so do I.
The question for many is what a President Kasich would do about it.
So would you take legislative action?
Let's not get carried away.
At a town hall meeting in New Hampshire in January, shortly before the first primary contest of the season, Kasich was again asked about climate change. Living on Earth provided this audio.
I think that human beings do affect the climate, and I'm a big supporter of solar and wind and geothermal and efficiency, but I want all of the different sources. I saw Seabrook today. I'm for nuclear, too. I mean, I'm for all of this.
Two-thirds of Ohio's electricity comes from coal. Emissions from coal are considered the largest contributor to global climate change in the U.S. Kasich has said the state would continue to burn coal without apology. He's come out against action by the Obama administration to curb carbon emissions that cause climate change.
And I think the other part of it is, let's not go so fast that we throw this kid out of work or this gentleman out of work. It's got to be a balance between a good environment and economic growth, which we can achieve. If you work at it, you can achieve it.
Governor Kasich is not necessarily your truest, bluest, greenest friend or the environment, nor absolutely is he an enemy, outright arch enemy of the environment.
That's Jack Shaner. He's with the Ohio Environmental Council. Kasich was slammed by environmental groups for freezing Ohio's renewable energy program for 2 years. The program required utilities to replace some energy from coal with alternatives like solar and wind. But Shaner says without Kasich, it would have been worse for renewables. The Republican legislature wanted to completely eliminate the clean energy mandate.
Governor Kasich gets credit for salvaging and holding the wolf from the door, so we did not suffer an outright repeal of our clean energy standards. We were disappointed he wasn't more active earlier in that debate and didn't exert his leadership and get this legislature to back down.
Kasich has split with some in his own party by pushing a tax on the oil and gas industry. There's a similar debate in Pennsylvania. Many Republicans say it would drive the industry away. Here's Kasich at his State of the State speech last year.
I'm disappointed by those that say the severance tax reform will kill the industry. That's a joke. That's a big fat joke, because I've talked to them in private. And I'll tell you what, our severance tax will still be competitive with other energy-rich states.
The Ohio Environmental Council praises Kasich for these efforts and for preventing oil and gas drilling in state parks. The council's Jack Shaner says Kasich has also put big bucks toward reducing toxic algae in Lake Erie. On the other hand, Kasich started something called the Common Sense Initiative. Shaner says it makes creating new environmental regulations difficult, especially if they cost anything to the private sector.
So here again, this is sort of the mystique of John Kasich. You cannot just categorize the guy. He is complicated.
When it comes to environmental policy, Shaner says Kasich marches to his own drum. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The people who check up on gas wells in Pennsylvania, who are charged with protecting streams and air, those people have a technology problem.
It takes minutes, sometimes hours, for web pages to load, if they load at all.
He's not talking about 15 years ago. That's what it's like to work at the Department of Environmental Protection today. Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, getting regulators up to speed. Stay tuned. According to the group Penn Environment, millions of Pennsylvanians live within the potential evacuation zone for a crude oil train accident, putting them at risk in the event of an explosion. Now, in a new study, Penn Environment looks at oil train routes in four Pennsylvania cities, Philadelphia, Reading, Harrisburg, and Pittsburgh, using the EPA's environmental justice methodology. I reached Zoe Sina-Sklar at her office in Philadelphia and asked her what they found.
There are hundreds of thousands of people across the state who are impacted by oil trains who live within the evacuation area that is recommended in the case of an oil train spill and derailment. What's new that we found is that people of color and low-income communities are disproportionately at risk from oil trains, that oil trains disproportionately go through low-income communities of color.
I want to talk about some of the statistics that you uncovered in the report. For example, in Philadelphia, I thought they were especially striking. What did you find there?
I actually would say that some of the most striking findings are in Pittsburgh. So if you are not white, you are more than twice as likely to live in the oil train blast zone than if you are white. And if you are also living in a low-income community and are a person of color, then you are over three times as likely to live in that blast zone than if you are white. And in addition, 70% of people who live in environmental justice communities as classified by the EPA are within the oil train blast zone, and that's compared to about 22% of white people.
I think a lot of people would be surprised by these numbers. I'm just wondering if you were surprised by the statistics as you were putting this report together.
More than surprising, these findings were depressing to me. Already, we are having many conversations as a nation around the reality of racism today in our country. And this is a story that I think ties into stories in Flint, Michigan, and ties into stories across the country where the negative impacts of environmental contamination and of industrial processes is a heavy burden on communities of color.
Are these risks associated only with where rail lines are located, or did you see efforts to reroute around wealthier areas?
I can say that in Philadelphia, many of the industrial areas are areas where there are larger communities of color. I would say that at the end of the day, the intentionality does not matter so much as the reality that low-income communities of color face disproportionate risks of explosion and also have to deal with the daily anxiety, with the daily noise, with the daily air pollution that comes with oil trains going through their neighborhoods.
Right. You say even if there isn't an explosion, crude oil trains contribute to conditions that already impact these communities. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
For sure. So these trains are coming through neighborhoods every day across our state and in our largest cities. They are idling, and as they do so, they emit volatile organic compounds that contribute to smog. They create noise in the neighborhood. I spoke to a woman in Philadelphia who says that the noise of trains moving through and stopping and rattling often wakes her up in the evenings. And then so that is a very small scale, but very real negative impact on a daily basis. And that is also coupled with the stress of knowing that these trains carry incredibly explosive, incredibly dangerous crude oil that could explode, that could end their lives at any moment.
So in light of these findings, what are you calling for?
So first, I would like to highlight something that folks can do at the local level. One thing that we call for in our report is for there to be community meetings with the offices of emergency management in these cities to educate the public about the trains that are coming through their communities, to tell community members when these trains are coming, what they are carrying, and most importantly, what the evacuation plan is in the case of an emergency.
One of the recommendations that you make in the report is for the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection to establish what you call appropriate protections to ensure that these communities are no longer disproportionately impacted. How would they do that?
So I think there are small steps and there are big steps. I think certain small steps include requiring lower speed limits, working to fix the aging rail infrastructure as well as bridges over which these trains are traveling, and requiring two conductors, requiring phasing out the old and dangerous DOT 111 trains, and requiring more inspections of these trains and these rails. And then I think a bigger step would be rerouting trains around these heavily populated areas. It is a huge risk to have these trains going straight through downtown, and a risk that really, in my view, cannot be mitigated. I think that the reality that the negative impacts of oil trains are so unequal should be another reason for swift and determined action by officials at all levels of government. And long term, I would say that the appropriate conclusion would be that these trains are never safe to communities and should be banned.
Well, thanks very much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Zoe Sina-Sklar is with Penn Environment. You can see their joint report with Action United and Forest Ethics, which includes maps of evacuation zones, at our website. That's AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. When companies go bankrupt, they shutter storefronts and hold fire sale auctions, right? Not in coal country, where they continue to do business. Inside Energy's Lee Patterson reports about what bankruptcy for energy companies actually looks like on the ground.
Bankruptcy does not mean that a business just shuts down. And as we've heard from Donald Trump, who owns a few companies that have filed for bankruptcy, it happens all the time.
Out of hundreds of deals that I've done, hundreds, on four occasions, I've taken advantage of the laws of this country, like other people. I'm not going to name.
Last year, nearly 25,000 businesses filed for bankruptcy in the U.S. Many of them filed for Chapter 11. In Chapter 11 bankruptcy, a company comes up with a reorganization plan that allows it to stay alive and pay back some of its debts over time. One thing companies often do is cut jobs.
It's a common story here in eastern Kentucky. The coal industry continues to see round after round of layoffs.
This TV news report about potential cuts at Alpha Natural Resources is from July, just weeks before the company declared bankruptcy. According to data from S&P Global Market Intelligence, Central Appalachia lost around 19% of its coal mining jobs last year. In Wyoming, the drop was a lot smaller. Just 1.5%.
I'm very worried about what's going to happen.
That's Gene Wagner, a former miner who lives in Gillette, Wyoming.
Because coal mining has done a lot for the communities, and it's done a lot for the people that work at them.
Although Wyoming hasn't been hit with major layoffs, Gene Wagner's worry is real. Wyoming mines are still churning out coal, like this one, owned by bankrupt Alpha Natural Resources, but they're churning out less of it. Production is down in the state by 14% since 2011, and revenues from that production are down too. And then there's another impact to worry about, cuts to retiree benefits like medical and life insurance.
When it comes to bankruptcy, the ones that lose the most
are to workers and to retirees.
That's Cecil Roberts. He is the union president of the United Mine Workers of America. Roberts was arrested a few years ago at a protest in West Virginia. Crowds gathered to demonstrate against Patriot Coal, a spinoff of Peabody Energy, because the company was trying to reduce benefits for thousands of unionized workers. A similar scenario is now playing out with Alpha Natural Resources. The company has asked a judge for permission to cut medical and life insurance for nearly 5,000 non-union retirees. In court documents, the company refers to this $125 million liability as a, quote, financial burden, and getting rid of it would, quote, enhance the debtor's prospects of a successful reorganization. And the uncertainty doesn't end there.
I think there's a very significant potential problem and risk to the taxpayer with the pretty high-profile bankruptcies that have taken place recently with coal companies.
That was Sally Jewell, the Interior Secretary, at a recent Senate hearing, answering questions about another concern, recovering coal mine reclamation costs. Major bankrupt coal companies in Wyoming have hundreds of millions of dollars in cleanup liabilities on their books. These are among the many debts being dealt with in bankruptcy court, and ultimately, the hope is that the companies will emerge from bankruptcy and be able to put up assurances like cash or surety bonds for those reclamation responsibilities. And that's the thing. Although bankruptcy can impact coal communities, many really want companies to make it through alive, because shutting down completely could be even worse. And that's the outcome Pat Sweeney is hoping for. He's advocated for Western land issues for over 40 years.
I mean, from our point of view, we want coal companies that continue to operate because a viable coal company is the one who's the best at reclaiming the land.
Negotiations are ongoing between bankrupt coal companies and their creditors over which debts will be paid back, by how much, and in what order. But at least in one recent case, there's a bill that will likely be paid. In January, a bankruptcy judge approved up to $12 million in bonuses for executives at Alpha Natural Resources. For Inside Energy, I'm Lee Patterson.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Now let's move from coal to natural gas. Questions surrounding Pennsylvania's gas drilling law are before the state Supreme Court. The justices heard oral arguments in Philadelphia on Wednesday. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips has more.
An overarching theme from the two-hour session was whether the oil and gas industry got special treatment from the Pennsylvania legislature when it passed Act 13, the state's updated drilling law. If so, certain provisions could be ruled unconstitutional. One section addresses who gets notified if there's a toxic spill. The law only requires telling those managing public water supplies, not homeowners with private wells. Attorney Jordan Yeager says well owners should also be told.
We have over 3 million people in the Commonwealth who have private water wells. They're entitled to just as much notice if there's been a contamination incident as people on public water.
An attorney for the state argued the Department of Environmental Protection has never regulated private drinking water wells. The court will also decide a whole host of issues, including the role of the Public Utility Commission when it comes to withholding drilling impact fees and whether eminent domain can be used for building gas storage facilities. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It turns out that as Pennsylvania's natural gas industry has been booming, state environmental regulators have been behind the times when it comes to technology. The head of the State Department of Environmental Protection, Secretary John Quigley, often complains that gas industry workers carry iPads in the field, while his staff is stuck with paper and clipboards. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick looks at efforts to bring the agency into the 21st century.
Remember those early commercials for Apple's iPhone?
Yep, there's an app for just about anything.
only.
Nearly a decade later, DEP staff is just now getting permission to add apps to their government-issued iPhones. This is good news for Scott Perry, who heads the agency's Oil and Gas Bureau.
So our folks could put decibel meters on their phones and understand if they're dealing with a noise problem.
From his office on the top floor of the Rachel Carson Building in Harrisburg, he sees more positive changes on the horizon.
We're looking at putting in Wi-Fi in this building. We do not have Wi-Fi.
Why don't they have it yet?
Nobody ever wanted it before.
That's DEP Secretary John Quigley.
There has been such a turning away from technology over the last decade in the agency because of budget cuts. Just relentless year after year of budget cuts.
With us today is the Honorable Secretary John Quigley. John, thank you
very
much.
At a recent budget hearing, he told legislators the department has a major problem with internet bandwidth at its 6 regional offices around the state.
It takes minutes, sometimes hours, for web pages to load, if they load at all. Just horrendously slow internet service. We're in the process of fixing that. That will probably save employees about an hour a day on average.
Republican Senator Scott Wagner of York County was not happy to hear that. He told Quigley the department should throw its weight around, literally.
You mentioned about the internet side. Have you slapped your provider around? I mean,
we're about to.
Well, I'd be happy to come over and slap them around.
Republican Senator Bob Mensch of Berks County agreed the DEP was stuck in the technological past.
Yeah, I was on a conference call the other day with one of your locations, and we had a speakerphone on, and I actually heard a dial-up modem.
Yeah, remember this sound?
And in 2004, that was obsolete, let alone in 2016. So I feel your pain to that extent.
The lack of investment in IT means the private sector is light years ahead of regulators. For example, the gas industry trade group, the Marcellus Shale Coalition, built a database a few years ago for water quality data. It's made up of what's known as pre-drill or baseline test results. It's critical information that helps establish whether gas activity could have contaminated a water supply. The DEP stores that same information in a much less useful way. As Scott Perry explains, the data is in PDF documents on CDs.
To transition to something different means we need additional resources.
The gas industry allows the DEP to access its database, but Perry says it doesn't have the functionality he'd like. He's hopeful the department can eventually build its own database to analyze the information more quickly.
It really ought not to come to as a surprise to many people that companies like Shell and Exxon and Chevron have a larger capital budget than most countries, let alone the Department of Environmental Protection.
Meanwhile, the department has purchased nearly 150 tablet computers so inspectors can ditch the paper. Quigley says their productivity could double.
This is the year they get iPads.
But those iPads will still need solid internet connections. The agency's working on it. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front, where we haven't heard that sound in a long time. In fact, you can find us online on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Kara Holsapple. And if you missed any of our shows, we're also on Stitcher and iTunes.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.